Chapter 2. It had all started with Nakia. Tagutai Yasugai had known it even at the time. Every month that passed only reinforced his certainty. He had been there with Ahriman, Magnus and the others. He had spoken. He had argued. Much of the debate had taken place in the corridors around the great arena, some of it in the presence of the greatest of all of them. But after the Master of Mankind had spoken, of course, there was no longer any debate to be had. So many great minds, great warriors, they had all fallen silent at once. Perhaps they should have worried about that then, but no one did. Something defining had taken place on that world. At times, Yasugai thought that a terrible mistake had been made, at others that one had been avoided. No matter how hard he turned the matter over in his mind, the truth of it eluded him. He stood now, alone, out on the Altak, watching the wind brush the grass and feeling the sun on his exposed face. The empty landscape of Chogoris yawned off in every direction, unbroken by hill or tree. The vastness of it never failed to make one humble. It freed the mind. Yasugai had heard it said that the human mind coped poorly with the immense vacuity of his birth world, and that those who had been raised there were doomed to a kind of madness of insignificance. He narrowed his eyes, watching the blue-green haze of the horizon blur out of focus. Significance, he thought to himself. That is the real madness, to assume that we matter at all. He allowed his mind to run free of the shell of his body, drifting out of itself and sighing like a spectre on the immortal wind. He considered himself. What do I see? He saw a weather-worn figure, knee-deep in rustling rechki grass. He saw archaic battle-plate, reverently cared for but age-blunt at the edges. He saw leather-brown flesh, hard and mottled with ink tattoos, oil-black hair gathered in a topknot, a dome of crystals over his head that flashed and winked in the sun. He saw the trappings of his craft, a staff topped with a bleached Adu skull, the totems, the symbols, painted or engraved on the ivory of his armour. Look deeper. He saw the faint penumbra of force in the air, the heat shimmer of power, the harmonics in his movement. He saw the world respond to him, reaching out, aware of him in its dim, eternal way. That was all prescribed now. Since Nikea, such things were to be put away. He let his mind return to his body. He looked at the world with his own eyes. He breathed with his own mouth, and felt his own augmented lungs take in cold, clean air. It is what I am, Yasugai said out loud. I can no more put it aside than I could put out my eyes. His brow furrowed, making the long scar down his left cheek twitch. Something defining had taken place. It had all started with Nikea. The passage of time had passed like this. On Ulanor, the War Master had been invested. Yasugai was there, standing by the Great Khan's side, watching with approval as Horus Lupercal took up the office. The two of them, Horus and the Khan, had fought together to take the system. They liked one another. Of all his brothers, the Khan had only ever been close to two, and Horus was the first. Yasugai heard them confer in the aftermath.
I hope that I can call on you, Horus had said. You call, I answer, the Khan had replied.
Then they had parted. The grand gathering of Primarchs and commanders and battleships and officials dispersed, setting course for 1,000 destinations and making the warp light up with the trails of their passage. The Great Crusade commenced again, though this time with a War Master at its apex, not an emperor. The Khan had been sent to the worlds of the Chondak system. He was sent to hunt the remnants of the empire destroyed on Ulanor, the last slivers of Urlak's greenskins. Perhaps some would have balked at that. It was not prestigious work, but the Khan was happy enough. It was hunting, and in a way that he understood. Cavalry charges across open spaces, going up against prey that had no concept of capitulation or self-pity. He had never complained. Nearly all of his legion went with him, ranked in their various brotherhoods, eager for the hunt. Scores of white ships cut the void, each crammed with warriors of the Ordu, all desperate to get back in the chase. Isugai did not go with them. Other duties called. An obscure world had appeared on Legion communiques during the final phases of the Ulanor campaign. The Sigilite's marker had been on many of them. Others were classified, for the eyes of the Emperor's gene sons only. That was the first Isugai knew of Nykaea. Back then he had thought little of it. What was one world amongst the thousands the Legion had already charted? So many worlds had come and gone, falling one by one under the aegis of the ever-expanding Imperium of Man. But it turned out to be more than that. In the end, it became everything. The fulcrum upon which the fate of a species turned. He wished he had known at the time. Perhaps he might have found some way to prepare for it better. The outcome might have been different.
"We will look back on this and weep,"
Ahriman had told him after the verdict. Isugai had nodded.
"You are right," he had replied.
He walked through the grassland. The stems parted before him like water. Khum Kata was days distant, long since fallen below the smooth horizon. He was in the lands of the Khan now, the old Talskar hunting ranges. Few prey beasts remained. They had become too good at hunting them, too careless at restraining themselves. Isugai thought that if he had taken a Berkut out with him, perhaps he would have spied something cowering out in the openness, belly pressed against the earth and ears twitching. Then he could have gone after it in the old way, using the strength of his body and the agility of his mind. No weapons, no weather magic. No, that would be a sham. He could never go back. Everything had changed, for better or worse.
"I do not know what to do," he said out loud, as if the Altak could hear and answer. "My dreams do not answer. Why is that?"
The wind said nothing. It pushed against him, buffeting across his breastplate and wearing at the ceramite edges of his shoulder guards. Something strange was happening. He had no words to describe it precisely. He had awoken one night with the sense that the entire galaxy was convulsing, like some vast creature disturbed in its sleep. He had heard screaming from far away. It had felt as if the screams were coming from worlds on the edge of knowledge, burning like candles in the infinite dark. But that was impossible. If he had put his gifts aside, as he had been commanded to do, he might have avoided such dreams. But the tests of heaven did not come and go. They were not like clothes that one could discard. They were in his blood, in his breath. Since the Khan, whom the Trigorians called Kargan, the Khan of Khans, had left for Chondax, nothing had been heard of him. It was as if a great veil had been draped across the sector. No astropaths penetrated the shroud. No communications of any kind came from the other side. Such blackouts were hardly rare. The way of the warp made any kind of long-range communication unpredictable and prone to interruption. But something about the completeness of it made Yasugai uneasy. Other sectors had also gone quiet. He had heard rumors that the light of the Astronomicon was becoming intermittent. The master of the orbital defense grid on Chagoris told him that some ships had been lost entirely, something that, with Legion-sanctioned navigators, was rare. By themselves, such signs were not sufficient to cause alarm, for the galaxy was a perilous place, and the Great Crusade had only succeeded in banishing some of those perils. For all that, it was hard to shake the creeping sense of something happening. Yasugai snorted to himself. Something happening. Can I be no more exact than that? But he could not. There were no interpretable patterns, no signs that could be read and understood. That alone was cause for concern. He stopped walking, still knee-deep in grass, alone amid an ocean of nothingness. He saw the tips moving in gentle waves, travelling in ripples like whispers. Some comfort was in those movements. Such undulations had swept across these lands long before the first explorators had arrived in bulky colony ships, ready to seize mastery of the emptiness and bend it to their will. When the hand of mankind was gone again, as it most assuredly would be one day, the grass would still be there, whispering and undulating in a hollowness of cold air and hard sunlight.
I cannot stay here.
The resolve had been growing for days, and now it reached crisis point. His orders after Nikea had been clear. Return to Chagoris and await further instruction. He had waited for those instructions a long time, and it could no longer be believed that they were likely to come at any point soon. Yasugai was, and had always been, the Kargan's counsellor. The two of them had forged an understanding, a way of dancing around one another until the truth emerged. Yasugai knew that he needed the Primarch. He flattered himself that in some less obvious way, the Primarch needed him. They had complementary skills. They had shared enough long campaigns and endured enough hardship to trust one another's judgment.
He would not have failed to summon me. Something is wrong. I have lingered here long enough.
No more insight would come to him on Chagoris. He would have to find his way to the Legion, swimming against the turbulent warp currents until the mystery of the Veil could be resolved. From the inquiries he had already made, he knew that would be difficult.
It's like a storm, the master of the orbital defense grid had told him. A huge one, eating up systems. I've never seen the like.
It would have been safer to stay on Chagoris, perhaps wiser too. But safety had never been a concern of his, and ever since Nikea, the limits of wisdom seemed to have been soundly breached. Yasugai stood square, leaning on his skull-topped staff and gazing up into the clear heavens.
I could walk these plains for a lifetime and not find the answer, he said out loud,
his voice snatched away by the wind and turned to nothing.
The time has come to seek it in the void.
Then he remembered what Ahriman had told him on the last day that they had spent together on Nikea.
Magnus will not stand for it, he had warned. Once a mind is opened, it can never be closed.
He had leaned closer. Yasugai remembered how it had been, the closeness between them, the shared understanding between kinsmen of the Librarius.
Speak to your Khan. He has always been with us. He understands.
Yasugai had nodded.
I will. When I can. But he can be hard to find.
So I hear. Try, though. Magnus has need of friends.
and we have need of allies. Speak to him. Since then, nothing. No word from Prospero, or Chondax, or Nikea, or Terra. It was as if the universe had closed in on itself, holding its breath, tensing for some terrible trauma to come. Yasugai started to walk again. He would go back to Kumkata, and from there he would take ship. He had been alone for too long, and now a change needed to be made. It had all started with Nikea. He still had no idea where it would end. Ships gathered like sleek grey sharks in the void, ghosting on low thrust above the rusty glow of the Alexis Nebula. Dozens of capital vessels hung at rest, immense and turreted, prow lights blinking gently above the abyss. Each was attended by a school of lesser craft, fleet runners, frigates, outriders, gunships. All of them had the same battle-burned look, the same scorched engineerium flanks, the same pockmarked hull plates. Some limped along on a scintilla of normal power, enclosed in webs of scaffolding and gun drones. Others were carved open, exposing striated lattices of inner decks. The flickers of a million arc welders danced across the honeycombs, pricking the soft murk of the gas clouds. Only one type of fleet in the galaxy had such a profile. The Imperial Army possessed larger complements, vast conglomerations of swollen troop carriers and supply behemoths. But they had nothing to compare with such concentrated killing power. Only a Legiones Astartes battle group could muster such monsters of murder. Each was gunmetal grey, adorned with runes and bearing the shamanic company signatures of Fenris. Each had been made to reflect the savage hearts of those who piloted them. The prows were muzzles, replete with the curving lines of jowl snarls over jutting forward lances. They were slivers of ferocity, hammered into dagger-shaped lines and given hearts of growling, unending fire. Hrafnikul was at the centre of the muster, heavier and more brutal than any other, ploughshare bowed, spine curved with the jagged profile of 1,000 defence towers and drive housings, belly lit with the dull light of ruinous weapon batteries. The shadows of its attendants, fleet tenders, maintenance vessels, shuttles, guard destroyers, crawled across its colossal flanks like clouds across a mountain face. Its command bridge was huge and echoing, a dome of bronze and marble supported by pillars of glittering granite. Tiers of decking rose up on the inside of the circular walls, each humming with subdued activity from the 1,000 grey-shifted crew members at their stations. The central vault, a wide expanse of bare stone under the colossal armour-glass roof, flickered with a series of hololith root projections, rotating kaleidoscopes of neon light that swirled and reflected from countless picked screens and observation lenses. It smelled of stone and leather, the aromas of forge and fire pit. Naked flames burned in iron grates and stained the walls black. Runes were everywhere, carved into the walls, the floor, even the glass. One figure dominated that space, the embodiment of every savage aspect that looked down on him, as bestial and magnificent in profile as the vessel he commanded. He was the master, the undisputed Alpha Beast. The Primarch Leman Russ, though, did not move. The operations of his flagship took place in a seamless dance around him, like lesser satellites spinning around a gas giant. Every so often his piercing eyes would dart towards some hololith readout or lens feed. Then they would flicker back, inscrutable and frost-hard. Two grey-pelted wolves with yellow eyes and grizzled haunches slunk at his heels. Every so often one of them would growl low, sending soft vibrations running across the marble, like the crack of glaciers sliding over scree. The wolf king's jarls stood in a loose ring around him, each one a lord of combat in his own right, swathed in pelts and armour plates and totems. Rune priests stood amongst them, their bone-white hair and painted skin vivid in the dancing light. In normal times they might have laughed with one another, growling in jest and challenge, gold-pinned eyes glittering with coarse-edged humour. No one laughed now. Not since Prospero. Not since they had all slumped to the earth on that fire-scoured world and saw what they had done to it. For some reason, Prospero had been different. Russ had always laughed before, sometimes with genuine humour, sometimes with a kind of wintry satisfaction in violence. Now he hardly even smiled. The cut lines around his sun-dried face seemed a little deeper.
"So, when will we be ready?"
the Wolf King asked at last. Gunnar Gunnhild, the one they called Lord Gunn, spoke first, as was his right. His voice had grown hoarse since the Battle of Tisca. He'd taken a blade across the throat that had kept him under the knives of the fleshmakers for 2 days.
10 days. Terran Sidereal, he said.
More, objected Ogvai Helmshrot, Jarl of the Third Great Company. 2 weeks.
Not good enough, said Russ.
Ogvai bowed. We will work harder. The Primarch didn't so much as glance at them. He seemed distracted, his mind lost in another place.
This delay harrows us. We should have been on Istvan. Now we must respond.
His jarls did not respond. Some nodded grimly, others looked doubtful.
Has such a thing happened before?
Asked Russ, talking to himself rather than them, his expression caustic.
Do sagas exist in which the Wolf King was drawn to the wrong place, doing the wrong thing? Has our shame ever been greater?
Still no one replied. When the silence broke, it was not a Jarl who spoke.
If we have no shame,
came a younger voice.
At least I do not.
Heads turned. Russ's twin wolves let slip a snickering purr growl. The Wolf King's eyebrows lifted.
Who speaks?
A warrior of Traa moved forward, pushing his way to the heart of the circle. His face was riddled with new scars. It made him look like a phantom of the old ice, crisscrossed with hexes and witch marks. His head was part-shaven, his remaining hair as black as engine oil. He had a mournful face. He had always had a mournful face, even before Prospero had dulled the wolves' animal spirits en masse. He had no left hand. His armour-clad arm terminated at the elbow in a mess of augmetics and iron caps. A new gauntlet had not been fitted yet. The demands had been many.
Bjorn of Traa,
the warrior said.
One-handed, said Russ, nodding in recognition.
Bjorn's saga was already being crafted by the Skjalds. He had been there with the Horus demon and heard the words of mystery spoken by that thing. His stock had risen, and he was being spoken of as if some deep weird had locked itself on him.
That is a poor name.
It suits,
Bjorn replied coolly, flexing his half-ruined arm with something like pride.
It stands for all of us.
You wish to say something?
I am not ashamed, said Bjorn,
his sad eyes unwavering.
I saw the thing that brought us to Prospero. I heard some of what it said. The Skjald told me the rest. We ended evil.
No doubt,
growled Russ.
And Magnus was already lost, said Bjorn. I speak boldly. He was your brother, but it was right that he die.
Ogve, Bjorn's jarl, nodded slowly, chewing his lip. Russ noticed, and his nostrils flared in anger.
We were a sideshow, muttered the Primarch. Ferus is dead. We should have been with him. We could have stopped it.
Reports of Istvan V had filtered through to the fleet in broken snatches, blurts of astropathic half-dreams across an ocean of warp storms. Nothing had been reliable. Everything needed multiple readings and confirmations, but in the aftermath of Valdor's departure, the hammer blow had gradually become clear. Now they knew the shape of the tragedy. The Iron Hands, Salamanders, and Raven Guard were destroyed or crippled. The Sons of Horus, Alpha Legion, Emperor's Children, World Eaters, Death Guard, Word Bearers, Iron Warriors, and Night Lords had turned traitor. When the Star Speakers had finally confirmed the interpretations, bringing the rune webs with them to demonstrate the pattern of the scry, it had felt as if the universe were falling apart around them, collapsing into ruin in snatches of strange and incomprehensible gibberish. Even now the shock of it resonated, hanging like a pall of smoke over all of them.
We would not have stopped anything, said Bjorn evenly. We would have been part of the massacre, and few would miss us.
At that, Russ almost smiled, the hooked sardonic grin he used to flash regularly.
Aye, just a few.
The question is, said Lord Gunn, what next?
We have Dawn summons, said Ogvai.
Summons, spat Gunn.
That is what we are here for, are we not?
Asked Russ wearily.
We come when called.
When the All-Father calls, corrected Ogvai.
And he is silent, said Russ. Valdor would not tell me why, but he knew. Of everything that has happened, out of all the mistakes, that wears at me the most. Tell me this. What has happened to the Emperor?
None of them replied. None of them were qualified to. They averted their eyes and closed their mouths. Only their minds ran with answers, suspicions, guesses, fears.
He is stricken.
He has abandoned the throne world. He is dead.
Russ laughed then, but it was not his laugh of old. It was a strangled, half-committed sound.
This is what we need.
He looked at each of them in turn.
I will not take orders from my brothers. Only my father. He will speak to me. We will set course for Terra. Not because Rogal demands it, but because we choose to.
Lord Gunn looked up.
What then?
5 days.
The Jarl of On took in a deep breath. Ogvai looked pensive, some of the others doubtful. Russ glared at them.
No longer, he said. Return to your ships. Do what must be done. In 5 days, we leave.
His expression remained dark, but somewhere, sunk deep into his lupine face, amid the cracked flesh and golden eyes, a flicker of resentful fire still burned. The dead weight of grief was lifting. In its place came something else.
Never, not until now, have I been truly angered,
Russ snarled. And the twin wolves stood up at the sound, hackles raised.
I am curious to see where it takes me.
Beorth Rannikborn eased back into the Filkshire's command throne. He'd slept well enough during the off-shift and felt alert. The servitors and mortal crew in the pits below him were working away quietly, and the entire bridge worked with a calm buzz of activity. Commanding an outrider frigate like the Filkshire wasn't glorious work. They'd been stationed a long way from the main wolves muster, and the stellar sprawl of the Alaxis Nebula was a barely visible smudge on his rear viewers. Still, it gave him a chance to run the real space engines properly again. They'd taken a hit over Prospero from one of the few surface-to-orbit salvos that the Thousand Suns had managed to launch, and it had played havoc with his systems ever since. He'd had his tech priests working on it continually, but the core of the problem continued to elude them. It really needed the attention of an Iron Priest, but they were all fully occupied with the big capital ships. All things considered, the Filkshire had done all right. Patrol duty on the edge of Fleet's sensor range was at least moving.
"Anything to report?"
he asked his bridge lieutenant, Torve, a sandy-haired Kael from one of Fenris's tribute worlds. He could never remember which one.
Sensor ghosting at our auger limits,
Torve replied, his honest face looking up for a moment from a cluttered console.
Probably nothing. Want to take a look?
Rannikborn didn't, not really, but there was little else to do, and the crew got restive with nothing to occupy them but vector plotting.
That's why we're out here, he said. Course adjustment? A nudge,
replied Torve, glancing up at a roof-mounted pict screen with glowing lines picked out on the glass.
Do it then.
Torve complied. A few seconds later, Rannikborn felt the dull whine of the engine's altering pitch. It still wasn't quite right. A grinding rather than growling. Trajectory markers on various picked screens scrolled away, plotting new routes.
Anything?
He asked after a while, absently adjusting the armrests on his throne. Aerulf, his watch officer, had done something strange to them last time he'd been in command on the bridge. He watched Torve run more tests. He watched the auger lenses on his throne console begin to feed him fresh locator runes. He heard the dull chatter of the bridge crew pick up by a notch, and saw a servitor down in one of the relay pits insert a spare interface node into a vacant shunt coil and start clicking excitedly.
Maybe.
Torve was looking intently at the sensor records.
Hold this heading.
Rannikborn sat up a little straighter. He looked up at the real viewports, a cluster of lead-lined crystal flex panes forming a blister over the upper bridge. He didn't know what he expected to see there. An unmoving screen of stars twinkled back at him, just as ever.
Yes, something, murmured Torve. Getting something now. This is not a glitch. This is a reading.
Rannikborn felt the hairs on the back of his hands stand up.
Detail!
As he spoke, he activated priority links to the Engineerium and Void Shield stations.
Feeding to bridge display,
said Torve, switching his incoming data stream to the main roof-mounted monitors. Rannikborn looked up at them. For a moment he saw nothing special. A blurry cubic schematic of local space picked out in glowing green lines, all overlaid with rune symbols and known vessel courses. It didn't change immediately. Then, just at the edge of auger range, where the definite gave way to the probable, something flickered into life. Rannikborn clicked open a brass keypad housing on the side of his throne and began punching buttons.
Void shields up! He snapped. Bring us about 2 points, Nadir. Ensure a line to the fleet.
The bridge immediately shifted into action. They'd all seen the same thing. The low drone of chatter changed in tone, turning tighter, more urgent, more directed.
Line established, reported Clyre, the comms officer. Insignia yet?
Rannikborn demanded, keeping a close eye on the Filkshire's trim and heading. It would be a bad time to lose the Engineerium.
Hull markings? I'll need to give them something.
Almost there,
said Torve, working furiously at his console.
They're still a long way out, but... Yes! Here we are!
The Picts updated. Something resolved in the corner of the screen. Shot down data lines to the cogitators. A single shape shuddered into clarity on the tactical display, rendered in glowing lines of phosphor. The Pict was poor, taken at an angle and extreme long range, partly shadowed by the overhanging lip of what looked like a lance housing. But it was there. A many-headed snake, rearing up against a circle of gold.
"What is that?"
asked Torve, twisting to look up at Rannikborn. Rannikborn felt his pulse pick up as he looked at it.
"I suspected you hadn't read my intelligence briefings," he said stiffly. "That's a new one. They seem to want to announce themselves."
He patched into the comm station. As he did so, more pinpoints of light started to spread across the auger cube. First a few, then dozens.
"Priority message to command," ordered Rannikborn. "Perimeter sighting of hostiles. Major deployment. Tell them we're scanning further before withdrawal. Assumed intercept course."
He watched the points of light continue to grow, like bacilli multiplying on a specimen dish. The numbers were getting more than uncomfortable.
"Ensure we pass those images on,"
said Rannikborn, his voice hardening as he calculated how long they had.
"Make sure they take them. Tell them it's a traitor fleet."
He swallowed, wondering how operational the ship's weapons really were.
"Tell them it's the Alpha Legion.